You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 11th of June, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live today at RadioAlbion.com, because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from RussJournal.org. Matt, good afternoon to you, sir. Top of the day to you. It's midday over there where you are, isn't it? How are you doing?
It is noon, and we're in the middle of a Maoist cultural revolution. And I thank God every day I live in Western Pennsylvania, where so far things have been very quiet.
Yeah, I hope you don't have too many statues around you. Have you got any monuments or statues that might be at risk at all, Matt?
I think any statue is at risk, especially if the protesters don't know who it is. They're going to assume it's someone bad and tear it down anyway. Hopefully it'll fall on their heads like that happened near you.
Yeah, I was just reading about that, about one of these statues falling down. Quite a few have been pulled down, and they were actually people that helped to get rid of slavery. It's ridiculous. It's just anti-white. They just want to pull down anything that reminds them of white people, I think. But we're going to be talking about China today, and China actually went through some of this, obviously, a few decades back, and seems to have learnt better, I would suggest. We're going to be talking about the rise of China as a superpower today, and NATO's response to it, particularly NATO's response to it. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has said the West cannot ignore either the military or economic rise of China, and admitted that the world is facing a shift in the global balance of power. Speaking to BBC Radio on Wednesday, Stoltenberg said Beijing was creeping closer to the West in multiple ways, through cyberspace, telecommunications, critical infrastructure, and in Arctic exploration. We cannot ignore the consequences of the rise of China. China will soon have the biggest economy in the world, and they already have the second largest defense budget, he warned. So is China really approaching first world status? I mean, what about the starving peasants that I've seen? I've seen them making fake eggs because they don't have enough chickens to feed themselves. What's really going on here, Matt? And also, I mean, if you listen to the civic nationalists, they keep pointing out that China is a communist country, as if it's just like the Soviet Union was 30 or 40 years ago. So those are two questions I really want to put to you. What about the starving peasants over there? And are they really a communist country, or are they more like a nationalist country?
I'm not familiar with starving peasants. The harvests have been pretty good over there. They are a first world country. They have been for a long time. They abandoned Marxism when the Gang of Four was all thrown in prison and Mao's elites were purged from the party. The notion of socialism with Chinese characteristics is their definition of national socialism. It is a essentially Eurasian, very conservative approach going back to Chinese history rather than Mao Zedong. So, but listening to Stoltenberg, you know, did he just discover this? I mean, these things were being talked about like this in 1990. He's just discovering this has changed. This has been the case for a very long time. You know, the U.S. has only a tenuous claim to be a superpower. They can't throw their weight around anywhere. China is certainly far better off in that regard. And the second largest defense budget, well, still less than half of the American, because they don't have private industries doing most of the work. So the notion of anyone says, you know, China is communist, knows nothing about China, even less about communism.
So it's probably just communist iconography that they're using there. You mentioned there that they're conservative, Matt, and I was looking at some of the pictures here, and they've got pictures of the Navy, and it appeared that they've got women there alongside men. I mean, how is the feminism sort of thing? How well does that go down in China? Because it did look to me as if they had mixed genders on this battleship. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's strictly for ceremonial purposes. Feminism, as far as I know, is not a force whatsoever in China. If it is, it's a Western import in the cities. So at the moment, it's no different than the Islamic world. But at the same time, it's, you know, women are educated and everything else. They don't serve together. There's no combat roles for women, unlike North Korea. So when I say conservative, I mean that you know, yeah, they may use the communist iconography, as you say, but the content of those things is going back to their history prior to the revolution. Not, you know, Karl Marx isn't really being quoted anymore. And when he is, it's usually sarcastically saying that it doesn't apply here. I would say it's a social nationalist country, very decentralized, but aware of the fact that it has to fill a vacuum left by the United States.
So don't judge a book by its cover, basically. Back to Stoltenberg here. The head of the Western Military Alliance also said it was important that Britain reviewed the role of Chinese tech giant Huawei in its 5G network to guarantee its security. He said he trusts that the UK government will design its 5G networks in a way that ensures they will remain protected and secure. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been heavily criticised over a decision to allow Huawei to help build Britain's 5G network. I do believe Boris Johnson is walking that back a bit. And I have to admit, I do have concerns myself about this, because Huawei are supposedly tied in with the government, and whatever Huawei have access to, the government are supposed to also be able to have access to. And if the 5G network is linked up with just about everything, which is what they say it's going to be, then won't that mean that the Chinese government have also got a back door into all of this, Matt? What do you make of their 5G connection?
Well, you know, 5G has been very controversial, whether or not it's necessary, whether or not it makes anything go faster, whether or not it has damaging impacts on brainwaves, because it does provoke the delta wave, which is a hypnotic sleep state. The very fact that these countries are attacking the Chinese giant here is because their own tech firms are upset. This is competition. As far as the back door is concerned, even if that's true, China is hardly unique in that sense. I don't know exactly how the technology is wired. It is partially owned by the state, not all the stock. It's run essentially as a private company. But they're no less tied to the government than AT&T is here.
So basically, China is catching up with the West technologically. And, you know, I would point out that this is due to all our resources going on diversity, all our resources going on promoting something which is against nature, rather than putting our resources into improving people's lives and technological achievements. And China has a homogenous state there, and they do their best by their people. And while we've been wasting our time on Black Lives Matter, they've been catching us up technologically. Would you agree with that, Matt?
I completely agree. It's a Han race nationalist society. The other race are the Mansuths, Tibetans. They have their own areas and they have their own economies. They've benefited from being a part of China overwhelmingly, but it is a Han state, you know, 85%, 90% of the population. So there is a racial component. They have very strict immigration law. You try immigrating to China, especially if you're from a non-Asian state, it's not going to happen. So even in that regard, they are way ahead of us in terms of race nationalism and everything else. The Western ideologies are rejected there, partially because they're imperial, partially because they're corporate, partially because they're Western.
And they're just making us weak, basically. The weaker we become, the stronger China is becoming. Well, asked about Stoltenberg's comments, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said that China does not pose a threat to any country and that she hopes NATO can view its development rationally, Reuters reported. Stoltenberg noted that Beijing is investing heavily in modern military capabilities and has added 80 ships to its navy in just the past 5 years. Years, which is equal to the total number of ships belonging to the UK's Royal Navy. China is becoming a more and more important military power, and we have to address that, he said, adding that NATO must ensure it remains a strong force in the future as it faces a shift in the global balance of power. So what about this Chinese military then, Matt? How strong is the Chinese military? Is it a formidable foe? Is it just defensive? We talked the other week about them having skirmishes with India. I've also heard this week that something's going on over in Taiwan. They've made some aggressive steps in Taiwan. So what is all this about the military here?
Well, the Chinese military is far more of a match than to the Americans or anyone else. NATO has every reason to be threatened, both militarily and ideologically. They're equal to anybody in technology. They're working with the Russians on, you know, as fifth-generation fighters. The carrier-busting missile, making aircraft carriers obsolete. And unlike in the West, they have a firm racial ideological center to them. They have a reason to fight. They don't have bases all over the world. So they don't need the almost trillion-dollar budget. And it frightens these people, as if adding ships to the Navy is a problem. Well, it's too bad. China could do what it pleases, especially when it's constantly being threatened by the West. And what the heck does NATO have to do with China anyway? NATO has nothing to do with this. The North Atlantic is right in the name. This is just, you know, someone, you know, pretending they're still a superpower, frightened because now they have competition. China does, after the Opium Wars, China owes the West absolutely nothing. If you complain about jobs going over to China, that's a legitimate complaint. But that's because of American and British policy, not because of China. Not only they're going over there and bringing stuff over. It's because they're subsidized to go to China. This is an American problem and a British problem, not a Chinese problem. They're just benefiting from it.
It does show that if you have nationalist policies, then that is the way for a country to go. If they want to improve the lot of the people there and improve their lives, then nationalist policies are the way to go. I mean, even with the Chinese that are immigrants in Western countries, China views them as an extension of China. They help them out with loans so that they can buy businesses, and they see the areas that get taken over by them as Chinese areas. That's the way they see it. And that's not the way our countries view us. They certainly are showing that nationalism is the way to go. Well, Stoltenberg was using the kind of language his sponsors understood very well, defending an established post-war order that had been in place since 1945, which NATO was created in order to sustain and defend. For decades, this order has been based upon parameters set by a geopolitical reality defined by North American and European socio-economic interests. The threat existed in the form of Soviet power and the need to contain the same. Once the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the NATO alliance kept playing the same game, replacing the Soviet threat with a new Russian threat. I'll just stop there, Matt, because this new Russian threat thing, I mean, that didn't come about for quite a while, did it? It wasn't until into the new millennium, around about 2010, that they started talking about Russia being a threat. So what was going on for those 20 years between 1991 and 2010? Who was the enemy that NATO was saying we have to stay around for in case this enemy provides a threat? What was going on then?
Well, in the 1990s, whereas the Soviet Union had collapsed and essentially the West took over Russia and liquidated most of its, about 80% of its GDP. It was a fourth world country for a while, losing population and everything else. There was a debate in the 1990s whether NATO had any right to exist. They tried to claim the Iraqi issue, the Islamic issue, because Russia, so long as it was a liberal state controlled by Western interests, was not a threat. It didn't see the Soviet Union as a threat either. It was too busy trading with them and engaging in high level trade pacts. Only when Putin takes over in 2000. Only when he takes over, suddenly, when it becomes a nationalist state, suddenly it's a threat. Suddenly there are sanctions. suddenly they're seriously saber. None of this happened during the Cold War. The only time the West got upset about Soviet expansion when they got too big, especially when they had China. When it got too big and they could keep the U.S. out of a trade pact, they got upset. Otherwise, there was always free trade with the Soviet Union, high-level military cooperation. It was always the case. So much of the entire Soviet military had an American foundation. So only – same thing for China. Mao was slaughtering people by the millions. No problem. Exploded a nuclear weapon in 1964. No problem. The minute they write a new constitution in the late 70s, become a national state in the late 80s, now we need to fight them. This pattern is seen everywhere. Only when it becomes a nationalist society, then all of a sudden the West goes ballistic. Prior to that, it was not the case.
Yeah, so I remember now it was Iraq and Iran and the Middle East. They were the big threat between 2000 and 2010. The world, however, had moved on. In the 70s and 80s, China emerged from its Maoist isolation, and by the 1990s pulled hundreds of millions of people from poverty-level conditions into Western-style middle-class lifestyles, servicing a domestic economic engine that dictated the pace and scale of the global economy unlike any other. In the past decade, the Chinese government has been implementing a policy of global economic engagement known as the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI. Through BRI, China has extended its economic tentacles into every third world market, accessing natural resources while building demand for products produced in China. Well, it seems to be implying here that China has just, you know, it's snuck up on NATO without them noticing, Matt. So is that what's really happened here? Why are they claiming that all of this now and making this big fuss about China now, and why not before?
Well, as we've said on this show many, many times, the COVID collapse, now the racial violence, the collapse of Western societies means that the economic recovery is not going to happen. So liberal society then needs a war. That's how they get out of problems. And I predicted this on this show, that it's going to either be with Russia or China, probably China. You could blame the virus on that. You could blame everything on that. But the truth is that the threat comes from the Belt Initiative, the Belt and Road Initiative. And that's the economic threat that Western corporations can't handle, because they're going to – well, they're doing what the West did, you know, and creating all these ties with the developing world. But they're doing it on the foundation of mutual respect. There's no ideological issue. States can have the governments that they want, the social system that they want. It's not a liberal order. It's a regional and national order. And they're offering loans on much better terms than the private banks do. You know, they're doing everything right. And again, showing that nationalism works here.
So they're using their wealth to build up their defenses, and they're using their wealth to invest in other countries without telling them that they also have to promote gay sex and diversity and everything else. Well, in the regions where BRI is active, China makes the rules, building the institutions which set the norms and standards that drive day-to-day life. It does so on the basis of a business model which does not seek to impose Western-style notions of freedom and democracy, and as such poses a grave threat to the interests of those who use freedom and democracy as code words to quantify the self-interests of NATO and its collective membership. China has used BRI to expand its influence into South Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and most worrisome to the transatlantic alliance, Europe itself, with BRI relationships already in place in Greece, Portugal, and Italy, and more being negotiated with France. Well, there's two. It seems it's contradicting itself a bit here, Matt, because they say that they're not interested in promoting this freedom and democracy, and yet at the same time they're saying that China makes the rules and it builds the institutions which set the norms and standards that drive day-to-day life. So, what do they mean by that? Can you tell us some more about this Belt and Road Initiative?
Well, it's a Russian and Chinese cooperative project. Because, you know, Russia, of course, is a big member of this. The attempt is to create a regional trading bloc, generally following where the old Silk Road, Marco Polo, traversed. It's mostly dealing with infrastructure and but rules that they're talking about, you know, during the trading regime. But as far as government and social policy, this is strictly a national idea. There is no interference in that sense. There's no political strings to any money that might be offered. These countries are already, you know, on their way to being well-developed. China has been a huge part of that. And the European side of it is what has these people frightened, because not only is France negotiating to be a part of this, but so is Germany. They see the immense wealth here. The dollar is nowhere to be found. And this is a huge portion of the population. So you have an ideological threat, you have a threat to the European Union, and you certainly have a financial threat. It shouldn't concern the average Westerner, but it definitely concerns people who run Citibank. And I guarantee you that Citibank will condemn it on one side of their mouth, but they're probably negotiating with it under a false name to get in on it on the other side of their mouth. But when you have states running things rather than private corporations, they can stay closer to the ideological foundation without getting into just simply profit for its own sake.
So it's purely to do with the economy and nothing to do with the politics. With the expansion of China's economic reach comes a similar expansion in military power projection. China has built a number of man-made islands in the South China Sea, which it has turned into military outposts defending the so-called Nine Line Dash, a contested demarcation line used by China to assert its territorial claims on waters similarly claimed by Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and others. So tell us about these man-made islands, Matt. Well, how do they make them? And what is the point of having these islands there out in the middle of the ocean?
Yeah, it's what they call a land reclamation project. There are seven locations. It's really by the Spratly Islands. So kind of in between all of these countries that you mentioned. They dredge sand onto the coral reefs, and then they pour concrete over that to make permanent structures. And there, of course, their infrastructure projects is easier to trade. And of course, the Chinese have, like the Americans would, militarized it, usually with anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems. And so there's an economic element here. There's a political, there's certainly a military element here. And when we talked about the Poseidon spy plane, the Chinese shot that, you know, laser pointer thing at it and they got all scared, that was over these islands. These seven locations that, you know, that China has essentially created land where there was none before. And they've negotiated with the Philippines and Vietnam, and they certainly have come to an agreement. They'll all join China against the U.S. if it ever comes to that. I'm unfortunately thinking that China's going to use ASEAN, they're kind of the Asian NATO, against them, but they know where their interests lie. All these countries have done very, very well with their trade relations with China. And they've been left alone as a result. The only people who are threatened by this is the U.S. That has no reason to be there in the first place.
Well, China's military buildup is seen as a threat to strategic shipping lanes connecting northern Asian countries such as Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan with the rest of the world. The United States has been working with these nations, as well as other regional allies such as Australia and New Zealand, to challenge China's position in the South China Sea, resulting in several face-offs between the Chinese military and the United States in that area. Can you go into a bit more detail about Taiwan here? Because that's also been in the news this week, Matt. So what is this problem between China and Taiwan? And why is the threat to strategic shipping lanes them having a military there?
Well, that's what the West says. Taiwan, the real name is the Republic of China. It was established in 1949 as the nationalists were driven out of the mainland. And of course, Chiang Kai-shek established a right-wing authoritarian military system that, again, created a first world country out of nothing in 20 years. Those kind of systems always work very well. They are enemies because they have this ideological divide going back to the Maoist era, despite the fact that there's a lot of trade between the two, sometimes off the books. It was Jimmy Carter who abandoned Taiwan and recognized China as the only legitimate China in the UN, which Taiwan's not a member, and proving that, again, they, you know, so long as China was communist, the U.S. had no problem with them. The minute they went nationalist, it became a different story. But a lot of Taiwan's military has a foundation in the U.S., so they can manipulate the Taiwanese economy and the military to use against China if absolutely necessary. I'm thinking that the trade between the two countries is enough to keep the peace. Peace has been kept for a very long time. But when the U.S. gets involved, they'll use any ally they can to get their way. But Taiwan's so tiny compared to China. If things, you know, it's been a cold peace for a long time. And I don't think it's going to change very much. But Taiwan, despite being small, is still very formidable.
Yeah, I can remember a time when everything used to be made in Taiwan. You know, all the electronic stuff was made in Taiwan, and now it's made in China. So Taiwan was an American proxy, basically, then. Well, NATO has seen itself morph from a purely defensive alliance to one which waged an offensive war of aggression against Serbia in the 1990s, nation-building operations in Afghanistan in the post-9/11 era, and a regime change conflict in Libya in 2011. This is not about a global presence, Stoltenberg said of his Pacific pivot, but a global approach. But a leopard doesn't change its spots, and the only presence NATO knows is a military one, which begs the question why NATO would be seeking to engage China in the Pacific. Well, I'll just stop there, because he says it's not about a global presence, but a global approach. And what that kind of implies is that NATO has taken over the world, doesn't it? Instead of having a presence on the global stage, it's saying that their approach is the approach of everyone. So anybody that doesn't have that approach is some kind of enemy to them. Is that what he's saying here, do you think?
That's exactly what they mean. That's why liberalism is inherently an imperialist system. It demands complete uniformity. That's what China is rejecting here. It is, you know, liberalism said that there is one way to function, and it's corporate capitalism and liberal democracy. But here, you know, again, why the heck is NATO all the way in the Pacific? It has to do with this, with the oligarchy. It has to do with their shipping interests and the fact that they can't deal with competition from a place they still think, in their prejudice, is still third world. Like, I think that way of Iran, even though it's not the case anymore. They see them as ignorant, and they need enlightenment from the West. And it's so absurd at this point. And this prejudice may very well cause a war.
So I would suggest that Putin's multipolar world, that's the opposite of NATO's global approach, isn't it? And really, that what you want is the multipolar world. You want a plurality of ways of doing things. Well, the answer rests in the near total subordination of NATO to United States national security interests. The United States military has been caught flat-footed by China in the South China Sea, with no viable military response to China's regional power projection. While the US Marine Corps is undergoing major organizational changes in order to better confront the military challenges posed by China, this transformation will take years and requires the support of regional allies which have been burned by the Trump administration in recent years. What sort of Marine Corps major organizational changes are happening? I can think of them bringing women into the military. Is that one of the things that's going on? But what are the regional allies then that have been burned by Trump in recent years, Matt? Which are these regional allies that are not going to want to help out, do you think?
I think what they refer to here, and we've mentioned it before, is Trump's idea that allies with the U.S. can't be dependent on American military or money anymore. And that's something that's, you know, an obvious thing, but these countries are in no position to rearm. You see all of these female defense ministers in Northern Europe, you know, Norway. Well, they could put anyone in there. It's the U.S. that defends these countries, not them. So now all of a sudden they're being told that they need to defend themselves against something. And the U.S. isn't going to pay for everything. It's not going to be American soldiers there. Now, I don't know if that's actually going to be the case, but that's the only thing I can think of what they mean here, that he's forcing them to pay more, and they're not going to do that.
Yeah, Trump doesn't want the American soldiers there. He's obviously unaware that after the war, places like Germany are under the control of America, and under the control of the Allies. An occupied government there. That's why the troops are there, and not so much to provide backup for wars in the Pacific, but to project American power into Germany, I would suggest, and to remind Germany of who the boss is. Well, Stoltenberg's Pacific pivot is little more than a false flag operation, seeking to use the NATO banner as an umbrella to draw together regional partners which might otherwise balk at a purely bilateral relationship with an unpredictable US ally. So rather than saying you're helping out the United States, they can use this excuse of you're helping out NATO. Well, you mentioned China and some of these countries in the EU, Matt, and we've got a quote here about Germany. China is not only Germany's largest trading partner, but also an emerging superpower, Foreign Minister Heiko Maas told Bild newspaper on Sunday. The European Union should, therefore, work out a shared strategy for dealing with Beijing, he argued. Brussels could not restrict its dialogue with China to economic issues only, Maas said, urging the EU to recognise its decisive role in the world trade. In the same interview, he notably described the US, Berlin's long-standing NATO ally, as a complicated partner. The EU and China sought to take their ties to a new level during a high-profile summit initially scheduled to occur this September, but the plans were shelved due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Maas said he hopes the important gathering will still take place by the year's end in Leipzig, Germany. Yes, but the problem with this, Matt, is that Germany is occupied by America. I mean, how can they make these plans to be doing things with China when for the next 100 years or whatever it is, they're under that law that the Allies gave them after the war? I mean, it doesn't really make sense to me. Can you break it down a little bit for us?
Well, it's going to depend on the American response. The European Union is completely doomed. Germany has refused to implement the American sanctions on Russia and trade, especially with fuel coming from Russia. And, of course, Mercedes-Benz has a huge Russian presence. Their banks do too. They're not going to stop, you know, making money in a huge market that they're very good in because the Americans are upset. And now the Germans are also involved in the Belt Road Initiative, as are the Poles. This is terrifying. So the Germans are really testing exactly how independent. I mean, formally, they're independent. They're in the UN. So they're testing these limits. You're not going to tell the CEO of Mercedes-Benz where they're going to make their money. They've ignored the U.S. on almost every major foreign policy issue, they're testing it. And so there's really no future for the EU at all. There's no money there. There's no unity there. There's no nations there. It's a decaying, broken down, indebted, increasingly impoverished place. And they're looking elsewhere for as far as their future is concerned.
Well, there'll be no Britain there from December onwards, hopefully, which is when Britain is supposed to be leaving. So what we've really got there is Germany just pushing it and seeing how far she can push it. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Lampshade. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.